Hello, and welcome back to the H-Span Podcast, your go-to podcast for longevity policy discussions. I'm your host, Dylan Livingston. Today, I am sitting down with Dr. Luigi Ferrucci, Scientific Director at the National Institute of Aging. In this episode, we discuss Dr. Ferrucci's path to becoming a world-leading geroscientist, what a day in the life looks like for the Scientific Director at the NIA, what he believes is the most promising avenues in longevity science research today, and advice for young scientists looking to get involved in the field of aging biology. I really enjoyed this conversation. Without further ado, here's Dr. Luigi Ferrucci.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to another episode of the H-Span podcast. My guest today is Dr. Luigi Ferrucci, Scientific Director at the NIA and one of the foremost geriatricians and scientists in the space of the biology of aging. So, Dr. Ferrucci, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Nice talking.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. I do really appreciate the time. I'm sure you're quite busy with everything at NIA. And so, yeah, I do appreciate you making the time. The first question I want to hop into here, Dr. Ferrucci, is so I like to ask my guests how they got into this field of the biology of aging, right? It's a
Yeah.
niche field, it's still very new. So can you tell us your background and your journey to become the scientific director at the NIA?
I'll be happy to do so. It's a long story, unfortunately, because I started to be interested in aging when I was a teenager. And I was serving dinner at the Red Cross in Italy. And there was a man that was waiting for his spaghetti to eat. And I was volunteering there. And so the guy told me, "What are you doing there? This is Saturday night. You need to be out chasing girls." And I said, "I really want to do something that is important. I want to contribute to the world in some way. So volunteer for the Red Cross is a great thing to do." And he looked at me and said, "Come here. If you want to do something important for aging, for the world, you need to study aging. Aging is occurring. It's going to change everything: the economy, the family, the healthcare, the relationship between people, how people move across the country. You need to study aging, and that will be the most important thing that needs to be done
When
here."
was that, Dr. Ferrucci?
That was many years ago. Let me think. It's really 50 years ago, really 50 years ago, without revealing how old I am, but it's
Yeah,
about.
I'm not good at math, don't worry.
Yeah, and then since then, I think I organized my life to do exactly that. So I went to medicine with already the idea to study aging. I got a PhD in physiology and pathophysiology of aging. And then I became the head of a section of a very large rehabilitation hospital for older people in Florence. But I was not happy because what we could do to help all the patients was not enough. So I thought that doing some research to understand better what we could do was the key. And so I started coming to NIA. And so I did back and forth NIA Italy for many years. I worked with one of my most important mentors, Jack Guralnick. And I studied epidemiology. And then in 2001, there was an international competition for the position of the director of the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging. And between me and you, I applied as a joke because I thought they would never hire an Italian, but they hired me. And so they didn't know what they were dealing with. And so I started redesigning the BLSA, the Baltimore Longitudinal Study of Aging, doing some research here. And in 2011, when the position of scientific director was available, there was a great opportunity to orient the field of aging research in the direction that I felt was important. And then I became the scientific director, and that is the end of the story. I'm still acting as scientific director of the National Institute of Aging, at the best job ever I could ever imagine to have. Dream come true that is still on giving.
Beautiful path there. Yeah, wow. So I have a few follow-up questions on that. But what interests me is someone told you that 50 years ago. This has been something in the minds of scientists for a while. And it seems that in the past 10, 15 years, it's really started to pick up with our ability to measure and see beyond just the cell, and kind of with the gains that technology has given us, things are really starting to pick up. But it's interesting that this has been something that you've been thinking about for a long time.
I think that, you know, historically, the study of aging was a curiosity. I think that it started in very ancient times. Mm-hmm. Seneca was talking about aging, but there was something that some would study for serendipity. Something that was happening was unavoidable. Mm-hmm. There was nothing we can do about it, but could be described. And that from the anthropological perspective was something quite interesting.
Mm-hmm.
However, at some point, people started realizing that age is not so fixed.
Mm-hmm.
It can be manipulated. So the first few studies in animal model were looked at knocking down some genes and finding that these animals suddenly were living double their normal lifespan. And so people started thinking, oh my God, aging is not so immutable. It can be changed. And then some studies were done, and other interventions that were not genetic but behavioral, for example, calorie restriction was associated with slowing down of aging and increased not only survival but also expanding health. And so people started to think that maybe this was the new medicine. Instead of waiting for the disease to occur, one can slow down aging, and by doing that, we can avoid those diseases, or we can delay those diseases to occur so we can expand the part of life that is associated with well-being,
mm-hmm.
absence of disease, enjoying life fully, and then compress the part characterized by disease and disability to the last part of life. In Texas, there was a say that I think it's dying with the boots on, then mm-hmm. what's still on your horse. I think that's the idea anyway.
Absolutely. It's, you know, this field has a lot of different opinions in it, but it's hard for me to push back against the idea of extending health span, extending your healthy years of life, compressing morbidity. You see a lot of people talk about living forever, and there's a lot of things that this kind of work can inspire. But I definitely prefer the language around, let's extend the amount of time we're living in good health, right?
Yeah.
However that is, but let's keep pushing that number forward.
There's a lot of skepticism, of course. It's very difficult to change a healthcare system that is based on the cure of disease. There's so much money invested that very difficult. Think one thing. You think that is established that hypertension and high cholesterol are bad for you. But in 1950, somebody wrote the protocol for the Framingham study. And if you read the protocol of the Framingham study, the hypothesis of the Framingham study is to hypothesize that hypertension and high cholesterol were associated with a higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They did not know, and they were scratching the surface of a knowledge that eventually will become the culprit of why we have been able to live much longer. The decline in cardiovascular mortality is pretty much related to the control of those two risk factors. Also, the condition of living, of course. But those risk factors have been really key in reducing cardiovascular mortality. Now we are starting now. Give us a few more years before we can demonstrate that this hypothesis is correct. I think that the skepticism to me is that people want results now. And
right.
Of course, we have a little bit of the hint that this may work, even in humans, but before we get to the clinic, it will take a while.
I have a number of questions to follow up with you on that, but I still have a few more background questions to ask you. But actually, before I do that, I want to talk a little bit about the US versus Italy. Can you talk a little bit about some of the differences in how people perceive aging there? Obviously, the healthcare systems are different, right? Italy has a single payer type of system. How do you, what differences do you see? And is one necessarily better than the other? Should the US maybe adopt an Italian aging perspective?
Things are changing, of course. So I'm going to give you an overall idea. I think that one of the big differences between the United States and Italy, at least up to a few years ago, is a little change in Italy as well, is that family were staying together. So, you know, you will grow in a city, and then your family was in the same city, and so your mother and your father were either in the same home or in the same neighborhood. And there was an imperative philosophy that you needed to take direct care of your mother and your father. And the percentage of people that were in nursing home was minuscule. When I left Italy, the percentage of all the 60, over the 65 in nursing home was 0.8%, really minuscule compared to the United States. Things are changing in the sense that life has become more complicated. You don't have the same stable job that you start at 20 and you bring with you up to the age of 65. I think that people are going from one job to another. This has created a lot more mobility and has little challenge this idea of the nuclear family that take care of the old people. But I think that the idea of old people as the wise part of the family that need to be respected and taken care of is pretty much still there, probably more in the south than in the north, because of the industrialization that in the north is much more prevalent. I feel that this is the most important difference. It's also, of course, the healthcare system playing an important role here. But I think that for older people, there is Medicare. So Medicare is a little bit similar to an universal coverage. So I think that it is smoothed. It's still different, but it's smoothed. What I can tell you is that there is an intermediate section of the population, those that are the early older people, those before the age of 65, between 60 and 65, where pathology is occurring, is more rare than later in life, and those sometimes don't have protection. That is the part of the population where the difference in having or not having healthcare is probably very large.
I was going to say, don't say that part about living with your fam around your family too loud, because my mom might call me. All right.
I've been the primary caregiver of my mother for many years. When I was living there, she was with me. When I left Italy, I was calling my mother every day, and I was supporting her in any possible way I could. I never regretted that.
Like a good Italian.
Yes, I never regretted doing that, because I think that sometimes in the moment was heavy, but then the memory, you feel that you fulfill your duty as a son.
I got to call my mom after this then. Another thing I that you've mentioned that is noteworthy is it's very uniform across societies that live a long time, is this idea of respecting and taking care of your elders, right? You can see that in not just in Europe, but in Asia. Right?
Other cultures, from Asia, that's even strong. In Japan, for example, it's very strong. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe that's the one of the keys that the U.S. should think about. Fascinating. Okay. You mentioned your path to get to where you are now, but can you discuss a few of the mentors that you reflect on still today that really made a difference in your upbringing and your professional journey?
I have to talk about a few people. I think that Professor Francesco Maria Antonini, that is the person that told me about studying aging, was certainly a very influential person. And although I did not interact with him a lot, his reading his work. Then he was the head of the Institute of Geriatric and Gerontology in Florence, and he had a very peculiar idea. The idea was that the medicine of aging is very complex. And in order to be really learned, you don't really need to do it to a nursing home, but you need to be in an intensive care unit. Because in an intensive care unit, the things happen very quickly, and you need to develop circuits in your brain that are almost automatic. So during my specialty, I was for 5 years in an intensive care unit and in a coronary care unit. So that was really helpful because you really need to learn medicine, because when you're confronted with a patient that arrived at 3 o'clock at night and you're alone, you need to know. There's no faking there.
Right.
And so I think that I learned the medicine there. And then while I was there in the intensive care unit, I learned the technique of intensive care by Niccolò Marchionni, who was a professor of gerontology, is now retired, but was really very good. And really, him and some of the nurses in the intensive care unit taught me a lot. They were very rigid. They wanted exceptional quality work. And at that time, it was tough. But today, at the age of, I will not tell you how much, I'm still doing microsurgery, fast loading on what I learned during that period. And then when I came to the United States, I met Jack Kuralnik. Certainly, he has been my mentor as a geriatric medicine, but especially as an epidemiologist. And he really taught me everything that I know about research and science. I think that his mentorship would be fundamental to me. And then I've done the rest by myself. I guess that I am characterized by an insatiable curiosity. That has been the characteristic of my entire life. So when I see a problem, like I have a worm entering my brain that I can't really get rid of until I have the answer. And that helped me a lot.
That's a good trait. Yeah, infinite curiosity is the key to discovery. Absolutely. I just want to touch on something you said before. I've noticed personally that there have been an influx of MDs, and specifically, I have a few friends in the aging space that were actually ICU or emergency doctors in some capacity and then made the switch. I guess it probably does rewire your brain in a certain way, and you have to be really learning on the job. So that's fascinating. I didn't make that connection until now. So you came to the US in the early 2000s, right?
Yes, I started coming in 1988.
Okay, 1988.
But I was going back and forth. I had a relationship with my institution that I could spend up to 3 months every year in the United States. And then the rest of the time I was doing mostly practical medicine, patient, outpatient, in this very large hospital. 2002, I came here, and that's what was my unique job, being the director of the BLSA.
2002, you came over. 2011, you became the scientific director until today. My question for you is, how has the field progressed in your opinion? You've been around it for years now, but specifically from the time you came to the NIA in 2002 till now, how do you feel the field is progressing?
So I think that the conceptualization of geroscience was already in a seed. Everybody had the idea that there was something related to aging that was at the root of chronic disease and disability, but has never been expressed in a very open way. And the idea that the geroscience hypothesis, the formulation of the geroscience hypothesis by Felipe Sierra and Rowan Kowalski, really changed the field, and changed the field in a way that we need to study the biological mechanism of aging in order to interfere with aging and slowing it down. And then there was a second event that was extremely important, although it's probably also has been an obstacle. It's the discovery of the hallmarks of aging. No? That paper where a group of scientists pulled together a number of biological mechanisms that were the basis for the aging process. So this created an enthusiasm around the field, and everybody wanted to study aging by one mechanism or the other. I think that the obstacle was that why created this enthusiasm also delimited the field to few mechanisms. And we know now that those mechanisms are few of the many mechanisms that create together the complex puzzle of the aging process. So now people are going away, not away, but outside that legal circle, and understanding that there are other important mechanisms, and that the connection between those mechanisms is probably more important than the single physiology of each one of those mechanisms. So many changes. I think that we came from a descriptive study of aging where we were surveying and describing what's happening to the interpretation. Nowadays, we're able to study in humans those biological mechanisms and connect them, for example, to the ability to walk. We study mitochondria in muscle in human using MRI, and we see that those are connected with both ability to maintain mobility and ability to maintain cognition. And that is the basis for intervention. Because when you find those threads, then the second hypothesis you make is that maybe if I change this biological mechanism, I can also slow down the decline of mobility and cognitive impairment.
It's interesting. It feels like there are more hallmarks of aging being added on or considered all the time. So I guess Matt Kaeberlein, if you know him, he spoke at our fly in March, and he put up a photo of the map of the world in, I think, 600 BC. And what he said was, this is useful for us to look at, study, or has utility in that we can navigate a small part of the world, but it's clearly not the full map of the world. I feel like that's where we are right now. We have
this. Exactly. I completely agree. I think that's a very nice analogy. We scratch the surface. I think that, and we cannot really limit our idea to this. And that's why we need to bring younger people to the field. Those that are thinking outside the box, those that are confronting themselves with the problem of studying aging and come up with ideas that were not there before. And I think that really you need young mind to do this initial discovery. That's what we're trying to do at NIA, bring young people to the field and from different fields as well. The surgeon has started to be interested in aging. The neurologists understand that many of the diseases they're dealing with have to do with aging and so on.
Yeah. So the good news on that front is I was just at a, I don't know if I would call it a conference. It was a camp and I was a counselor, but the entire event was filled with college age students, graduate age students that were really not just interested, invested in making an impact in this field. So I think the young minds are coming, and I think that's a good message to amplify here. If you're a young person and you might not have the training in the biology of aging, your skills and the way you think about this problem and the world is useful, and you should consider dropping what you're doing maybe and come work in aging. So you became scientific director in 2011. We've seen a bunch of these changes in the last probably 10 years, specifically with expanding the amount of hallmarks we're looking at. So I would assume that the NIA's work, as all of these new breakthrough discoveries have been made, has changed as well. Can you talk a little bit about what your, maybe how the work at the NIA has changed and a little bit about what you're doing now?
I hope that I can say that I came to NIA, and NIA 10 years later is very different from what it was 10 years ago. I had a vision, and my vision was simple. We need to study the thread between the molecular mechanism and the behavior at the population level. And the best way to do it is to have a different part of this thread from the beginning to the end. So my goal was to harmonize that. How did I do that? What I did, typically you have laboratories that are focusing on one topic, but I had the idea that we needed to pull together the basic science with the clinical science in the same lab, in the same meetings, so that they could talk each other. And at the beginning, I can tell you that they were not understanding each other at all. You will go to this meeting, there was a speaker, and there were half of the people were really following, and the other half of the people were scratching their head because they didn't know what this guy was talking about or this girl was talking about. And then slowly and progressively, you perceive that there was an osmosis between the two groups. And so the people that were doing the basic science started to be interested whether what they were working on was relevant for human life. And the people that were doing the clinical side had a question that they wanted to ask in terms of mechanism. What is that explain what I'm observing in the patient or in the participant? And the only way to know was to go back to the basic scientist. And I think this synergy was born, and I think made a very happy place. I will say that everybody was happy to overcome these silos of science that were isolated and not communicating.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think communication between not just the clinical and the basic side, all the different sides, advocates, you know, economists,
yes,
right? There needs to be some level of communication between all groups in this aging effort. So I'm totally with you. When did those synergy meetings start happening?
Well, I think that when I became a scientific director in 2011, there was some financial issue that I needed to reorganize. So I spent the first 6 months just taking care of the basics. Mm-hmm. Then what I did was to have meetings with everybody and then explain what my vision was and then implementing that progressively over time. And then you can't really change things too quickly because then people rebel. Mm-hmm. But selecting the new tenure track investigator based on this model. And I think that NI is becoming one of the youngest institutes, believe it or not, at NI, because we have 18 young tenure track investigators that are really promising for the future of the aging research. So that started in 2002, but it was a progression. I think that the model that I had in mind in 2011 has been 90% implemented. There are a few little details that I would like to still improve, but I think that I'm pretty happy with what I have around, what I can see around.
The meat and
come visit. You will be impressed. I promise you that if you come and visit NIA, you will be impressed, especially in the clinic.
I got to come. I got to come up. We'll have to make that happen. I'm only an hour away. So are you allowed to talk about that last 10% that you would like to see?
Yeah, absolutely. No problem. It is really, I think that, you know, of course, when I was in 2011, I did not have in mind artificial intelligence, but I had in mind computational biology. The idea that biology is not characterized by linear system. We use linear system to analyze it, but we lose a lot of what's going on because of the multiple complex interactions that occur within the system. And so I felt that unless we could really put a person that was specialized into studying the biomathematical model that regulate this complex interaction, we could not really realize the dream that I wanted to realize. And I haven't found the right person to do it yet. And of course, that computational biology has become artificial intelligence. It's a change in the name for something that intuitively we all knew that existed. That's the first part. There's another emerging technology that we really need to expand. We do a lot of ultra microscopy, especially cryo-electron microscopy, where we really look at the shape of the molecules. It's really so promising and have so incredible potential in it. But each experiment requires so much dedication, attention, and knowledge that it's not something that you can have someone else doing for you. You need to have something, you know, that is dedicated. That's where I would like to have those two sections. And if you think about it, those two sections will not work by themselves. Almost every other section in the lab would require some advice from computational people. And almost each part of our institute will acquire some ideas, some use of heavy ultramicroscopy technique to use. And I think that will make it round. That will make it at least the one I had in mind. And I hope I'll be able to do it unless, of course, we are constrained by budgetary problem, and those, there's nothing we can do about.
Yeah, that's part of my job here is to make sure that you guys have the resources you need to make all this wonderful stuff happen. That's have a question about AI. So you said you didn't find someone, you haven't found anybody to lead the AI effort yet at NIA?
No, but the issue is the AI is becoming so important and famous that people go to industry, and NIH cannot afford the type of salaries and resources that the best people are requiring. We can see them, and then when we tell them what we can offer them, they go to the big banks or the big software companies where they can make three times as much money as they can do with us. Few of the people that we can attract are attracted by, like me, by the passion for discovery, the idea that what you're going to do sometime is going to help the person on the street to be able to walk. That to me is the motivation. Not many people have that kind of motivation. So that is becoming a problem.
Yeah. I am under the firm belief that everybody in the government should be paid more, including the Congress people. And that might be a controversial opinion. But like you said, it's hard to attract the best talent when their salaries aren't competitive, right? When someone can go get an entry job for more money somewhere else. I'm with you. Hopefully we can help ameliorate some of those issues too. I want to ask you this, and this is a bit more of a personal question and less your work at the NIA, but is there a hallmark, potentially? I know that all the hallmarks interact with each other, but is there a hallmark you're particularly bullish on? Is there a field of aging research that you're particularly bullish on? If we solve this, then we will get this. Do you have some?
I think I'm biased because I am a mitochondrial-centric person. I think that if you think about what the hallmarks are, biological mechanisms that prevent damage to macromolecule or repair that damage when that macromolecule has been damaged. In order to do that, you need energy. So if you don't have enough energy, you will not be able to activate those resilience strategies. To me, the neck of the bottle is truly the availability of the energy through mitochondrial function. And that's why lately, most of my research is really focusing on mitochondria. And I think that we start to have some evidence that mitochondria are important for the muscle and for the brain, at least.
For all of you non-biology listeners out there, the mitochondria, if you remember back to your eighth grade biology class, the powerhouse of the cell. So I just like to, we get a lot of political type listeners, Dr. Ferrucci, so I just want to clarify.
The only organelle that once many eons ago were probably bacteria.
Right.
And then they started collaborating with cells, and then now they provide energy, a lot of other stuff to cells. There's a lot that people don't know about mitochondria. But for example, one interesting thing is that mitochondria is where cortisol is synthesized. Cortisol is the hormone of stress. When you're stressed, you secrete the cortisol to overcome the stress. Now, isn't that peculiar that nature put the energy and the stress hormone in the same organelle? It's because they're highly correlated. Mitochondria are the one that allow you to overcome crisis. Mm-hmm. And we can think about aging as a continuous crisis that you need to overcome. And if your mechanism of crisis response work very well, you do not age. If they do, the accumulation of damage is massive and fast, and then you have accelerated aging.
Can you talk about a little bit of the work you're doing on mitochondrial research right now, or mitochondrial,
yes,
please?
So we study mitochondria in many ways, but the most important one is we study mitochondria using nuclear magnetic resonance. So using nuclear magnetic resonance in muscle, we can monitor a particular compound called phosphocreatinine. Imagine that the phosphocreatinine is a battery. So the mitochondria create energy and put the energy into this battery. And then when you need the energy from the phosphocreatinine, the energy goes to the muscle. So we can monitor with MRI this. So we put people to exercise in the magnet. And then we see that the battery is depleted because people exercise, consume the energy, And so the index of the battery charge goes down. And then you stop, and the mitochondria work furiously to recharge the battery. And we can measure how fast the battery is recharged. And that is an indication of mitochondrial function. We have done this in more than 1,000 individuals. The study is longitudinally. This is the largest population that I ever been studied with this method in the world. And then because we follow these people longitudinally, we can tell what these people happened to them. And for example, one thing that we see is that those that have lower mitochondrial function have much higher risk of losing mobility and have a decline in walking speed, but also have more likely to develop dementia and more likely to develop MCI or cognitive decline, or to have positivity of those biomarkers in the blood that are indicative of neurodegeneration. So the mitochondria seem to be a bridge between movement and cognition. And so that's why we're so interested in that. And of course, we do a lot more than that. I think that I do a lot of muscle biopsies, and we look at mitochondria under this ultra microscope, and we see what are the morphological and architectural changes that occur during the aging process. And I think that technology today is amazing. And we can see that while in young people, those mitochondria are highly interconnected, they are really forming a network. With aging and with frailty, those mitochondria become fragmented. They're no longer talking to each other so much. And that really creates a problem, an energetic crisis in a way that condition many of the facts of aging. I think that a few words, that what we're trying to understand.
That's fascinating. I'm sure you saw that Nature paper that came out maybe a week or two ago that states that we as humans go through accelerated aging at, 45 and 60? Do you see any of that with the mitochondria as well? Are those like the time?
I never looked at that for the mitochondria. Actually, that's a good idea, and I should be looking at that.
There you go.
We have not looked at nonlinearity. But yes, I think that we see that with protein, for example. So we do a lot of biomarkers. That was done on metabolomic. That was Dr. Schneider, if I'm not wrong. And they look at metabolomic. We look at proteins, and the most frequent change in circulating protein that we see occurred around the age of 45 and 75. And so those seem to be moments in life where there's a lot of adaptation. Now, the interpretation of that phenomenon is still controversial, because I think that the aging is the balance and equilibrium between damage and resilience. So are those change an indication of damage, or are those change an indication that your body is massively responding to the accumulation of damage? We really don't know. And the question is very important. It will be more and more important as we want to use them for interventions.
I didn't even think about that. So how do you go about, is there some effort to tell what you to differentiate between damage and resilience?
There's little work done, very little so far. I think the best work has been done in the UK Biobank. Mm-hmm. What people do is something that's called Mendelian randomization. The Mendelian randomization creates a fake variable that is derived by genes. So the genetic assemble predict one certain variable. For example, mitochondrial function can be predicted by a certain set of genes, polymorph. Because the genes do not change with aging, you're born with the same gene that they don't change, then there's no effect of environment or behavior. And so you can see whether that fake variable is predictive of bad outcome, disease, multimorbidity, mortality. By doing this systematically across many proteins, people are starting to identify what are the proteins that are response, positive, resilient response to damage, or they are actually causal or expression of damage. I think that that work has just started. There's still some tweaking to do on the methodology, but I think that that's where the best evidence come from.
Absolutely. So I could probably keep asking you questions about this, but I want to make sure we get to all of our questions. So the last thing I'll ask you about your work at the NIA is, we talked about obviously the mitochondria. You might be a little biased. Are there other fields that, subfields that you're particularly excited about?
I mean, many fields that are promising. One that of the promising field, which is now revealing to be a little bit more complex than we thought before, is the cellular senescence. Cellular senescence, the cell that become unstable, can have many decisions to make. One of the decisions is whether they die. So they commit apoptosis so that they do not become cancer. Or the other option is to become senescent. Mm-hmm. So senescence is characterized by arrest of replication. And this senescent cell produce a number of bioactive compounds that create inflammation and management of the intercellular matrix, what we call the senescent-associated secondary phenotype. Now, we know that these senescent cells accumulate in the body, and that is a problem. One is because the senescent cell doesn't do what it's supposed to do anymore. So if you have an hepatocyte that is becoming senescent, no longer does the work of the hepatocytes. So the function of the liver becomes reduced. And the second problem is that they produce these bioactive substances that create a lot of trouble. So people have done animal model study to remove this senescent cell, and they've seen fantastic improvement, decline of some of the most important phenotype of aging, kyphosis, cataract, muscle mass decline. Now, they also have discovered some drugs that seem to selectively remove this senescent cell when the selected cell emerge. So they're called senolytic or xenomorphic. This senolytic and xenomorphic are studied extensively in our laboratories, both in human and in animal model. Mm-hmm. And then there are clinical trials already out there that are trying to see whether what we see in the animal also translate in human. I think that at the second part, they seem to be more important. This frontier work to me is what we call splicing variants. And let me tell you in few words what it is. So we have about 24,000 genes, and each one of these genes is coding for a certain proteins. However, with 24,000 genes, we have a million of proteins, because the genetic code in each gene can be rearranged to create multiple proteins, not only one. And that is one of the trick evolution has played. Instead of creating many more genes, has used those sequences in a much more clever way. I think that studying those splicing variants that emerge, mostly during stress, is going to be really the frontier of the future of aging research.
Beautiful. I do have a question, and I, at the risk of making myself sound stupid here, I'm going to ask it. So when we remove these senescent cells, right, I would, to me, it seems like there would need to be some replacement of healthier cells. So is that factored into this at all? There are when senescent cells are removed, does the body regenerate cells, or do we have to put some stem cells in there?
The tissue has its own homeostatic mechanism. As you remove a cell, that cell is somewhat substituted with the newly created and younger cell, because the other cell around that cell are able to replicate. So they will replicate and fill that hole. That is at least the theory. I think that there is some evidence that this is true as well.
Gotcha. That's good for me to know. All right. So look, I could sit here and ask you questions all day, but we're trying to keep this to within an hour. I want to jump to the sort of, I guess, my closing questions, the questions I like to ask all of my guests, really more advice for people and for the future. So the first question is, and we touched on this a little bit before, but can you talk about, or at least can you give a piece of advice to a young scientist looking to enter this field? What would you say to them? What direction would you give them? How do they get started?
Yeah, first of all, I would say that come to aging research because it's really hot and the field will be growing and the people want it. I always say the science of aging, the anti-aging industry is an affair of $170 billion in the world per year. And that is without an inch of evidence. Imagine how much would be if we had any evidence. It will grow enormously. So this is a field where there's so much demand and need that, you know, that's where you want to be in. I think that it's the biotech of the future, I think, that the study of aging. The second thing I would say that the most important thing to be old, the most important thing to choose would be to select your mother, your father, but you can't. But to be a good scientist, you need to select a good mentor. Your mentor conditions tremendously who you will going to become in the future. I think that it's really important and don't be shy. If the mentor is not really providing you what you need, just look for another mentor. Don't stay there if it doesn't work. And I think that you want a mentor that give you the help and attention, but also allow you the freedom of thinking by yourself and expressing your ideas. So it's a balance between those two things. The third thing that I want to say, but will not be very popular, is that the first part of your career, it's hard work. And I think that the people that I see successful are the people that put the hours and don't need to leave the building at 4:30. When I was a postdoc with Jack many years ago, I was leaving the building at 10:30 every night. And because that is the moment where you create who you are as a scientist. And so you can't really be on a clock. You have to know that you leave when you the things are done.
Right.
And be prepared for a few years, and then you can relax a little bit more. But for a few years, to be really working very hard, because that's the way you understand profoundly what you're doing. I think that would be the three things that I would say to a young investigator.
Those are beautiful pieces of advice and very actionable. I appreciate that. This is not a question that I was preparing, but what defines a good mentor versus a bad mentor? How can people decipher with their...
I think that there are several types of mentor. One is the mentor is somebody who cares for the mentee. Mm-hmm. And there are, I think, two types of scientists. Scientists that trainees because they are cheap work in their lab. You can see that very well because they make you do something, maybe always the same thing, but they don't allow you to grow and to really develop your intellectual capacity. And then there are the mentors that have the gift. And so they care, they are compassionate, they are understanding, they put the time to tell you what you're doing right and what you're doing wrong. And they're not afraid of telling that you're doing something wrong, because that is the way we teach. This, what you're doing is wrong, and I will show you how to do better. And only by repeating the same thing and learning something is where you grow from the technological perspective, but also as an individual and as a scientist. That, to me, is the real mentor. That somebody who put the time to make you grow.
Do you have any mentees? Are you a mentor of anyone right now?
I do. I do have mentees. I have few, not many, but I have few. I have two postdoc and one postdoc. And then I work with staff scientists who are people that are already mature. They are not principal investigator, but they've decided not to be because they like... And my team is very cohesive, very cohesive.
Beautiful.
So I spend with them a lot of time. That means that I do the scientific director in the morning and the first part of the afternoon. And then around 4 o'clock, I start meeting with them. So I never go home before 7:30 because I need to meet with them. It's a joy. That part of my job that I really love.
You said your lab is a lot of cohesion. Starts with good leadership, Dr. Frucci. And I will say, as an American taxpayer, I am glad that you're the one leading our efforts here at the NIA. And so I appreciate it. And I appreciate the extra time that you put in. The last thing I want to ask you before we sign off here, what I like to do is end our, because some of these conversations can get a little charged or heated, right? In this case, we did not have a particularly charged or heated conversation, very pleasant. But what I like to do is leave our guests with something positive to hold on to as they turn off their computer. Dr. Frucci, can you tell us what gets you out of bed in the morning? What gives you hope for the future? Why you're continuing to push on? It's a loaded question, I know. It's hard.
I love what I do. That's really what takes me out of the bed every morning. I know that we're coming here, and I know what I will be doing, and I love what I'm.
So your advice is to pick something you love doing.
It is the type of environment that I try to create for others. I try to create an environment where people in the morning wants to come to work.
Mm-hmm.
There's something happening that is beautiful and positive. And so that's why I come here. It's a joke. I always talk to my boss, Dr. Hodes, and I tell him that I went one of the lucky people that are paid to do what I would like to do anyway.
Yep.
I think that, can you imagine something better than that? I don't think that you can imagine anything better than that. Over the years, I had other opportunities, industries, people that were offering more money, more funding. And I think that MIA is magic. Being here, to me, I feel that is the best place to be for a scientist that is enthusiastic about science. And that's why that would push me in the morning to come here.
Absolutely. I think, again, having someone like you leading the staff there is key, right? Like creating this culture where you're actually excited to come and pursue this is absolutely paramount. I don't know if that's unique just to the NIA, that kind of vibe, or if it's something that the rest of the NIH institutes have too, but
I think NIH in general is made of enthusiastic people. I can't really make comparison between NIA and other institutes. But I will tell you that from the perspective of $1 million invested per publication published, we are the one. NIA is the most productive intramural program at NIH. We publish more high-level scientific paper per $1 million invested than any other institute. And so that is a big metric, maybe not, but it is something. I think that means that people put the energy into doing it.
Absolutely. Hey, you got to send me those statistics so I can use them when I talk to people. That's
okay.
That's powerful. That's powerful. And I, next time I'm in Baltimore, I'm gonna give you a ring, Dr. Frucci.
Please, I would love to show you what we're doing here.
Absolutely, absolutely, that would be an honor. I think that's about. We've hit about time here, Dr. Frucci.
Yes.
I could keep talking to you for hours, but and I'm sure we will talk offline. But I just want to thank you profusely for making the time here, for enlightening our audience, not just with the scientific endeavors at the NIA, but really, I feel like we got down and deep into who you are and what brought you to this point. So I appreciate you being so candid, and I look forward to coming to visit. I can see the harbor outside.
Yes, please come. You will like it, and we can maybe eat crab together.
Yeah, there you go. Beautiful.
Bye.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back in a few weeks with another installation of HBAN.
Live long and prosper.
Thank you, Dr. Frucci, for making the time to join us today. And for those listening at home, I hope you found this conversation as enlightening as I did. If you have anyone you would like to see make an appearance on our podcast, you can send your suggestions to us at info@a4li.org. HBAN will return in a couple of weeks, but until then, let's live long and prosper.